E-A-L.
Responsible eating, responsible eating, responsible eating and living.
Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and I'm here with my co-host this evening, Gary D. Matei, and you're listening to
Ask a Vegan.
This is Sunday, June 10th, 2012, and we have a fun hour planned this evening, so thank you so much for listening, and let's just get to it. But before we do, I want to remind you that any comments or questions now or during the week, you can send them to info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org. It's so important to hear from you because that's what this is all about, Ask a Vegan. You ask and we
tell.
And we tell all.
To the best of our ability. And I am a new vegan. I've been a vegan now for about 5 years. Karen,
how are you? That's not so new anymore.
I don't know. I might be considered one of the seasoned veterans pretty soon. And but still have a lot of questions for Karen. And Karen is more the seasoned vegan veteran. So you can get an interesting perspective from either of us if you ask questions. I know that I'm still eating a lot of the transition foods that a lot of new vegans eat because they're so tasty. And if you have any questions about anything, go ahead and write us at, what was the email address again, Karen?
info@realmeals.org.
info@realmeals.org. Okay, so we just got home from the Catskill Animal Sanctuary shindig yesterday, being Saturday, and it was really a fun event, and it kicked off. What night was the barn raiser?
Right, that was on Wednesday. You know what I loved about it? This was a fundraiser and information kind of event in Manhattan for the Catskill Animal Sanctuary, and it was at the New York Times building on the 15th floor, this beautiful space. And what I was thinking about was we have really come a long way in the vegan world because there was this time when people, if people even thought about vegans, they associated hippies
Grateful Dead
ragged,
concerts.
Simple clothing and very simple food. And then maybe about 10 years ago, I think it was a little more than 10 years ago, actually in the year 2000, PETA, the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, had, I think, the very first in my lifetime, upscale, lovely event that was all vegan. It was out in Los Angeles. It was called the Millennium Gala. It was $350 a person, which
wow,
was a lot. And, but many of us flocked to it because it was the first opportunity to be all dressed up and eating lots of wonderful food. And since that time, a lot of nonprofits have jumped on board and had a variety of different fundraisers, many of them upscale and elegant. And so here we are in 2012, and we had this little soiree.
It was wonderful, yes. It was at the New York Times building, as you mentioned, and the food was all green. And
it was all green, wasn't it?
It was very monochromatic. It was lovely.
There was an artichoke dish, which was green, and then there was an endive and asparagus thing.
You say endive, and I say endive.
Endive. And let's call the whole thing off. And then there was a spicy edamame, so all the dishes were green.
Yes, and it looked great. And the view was spectacular on the 15th floor of the Hudson River. Well, that was the Hudson, right? Yeah, I think it was.
It was really lovely.
And you know, we were at the New York Times, so it was great. And the Catskill Animal Sanctuary does some amazing work. And we were there at their barn or shindig yesterday and saw a lot of really incredibly amazing animals and a lot of hardworking volunteers. And a lot of people showed up for that. You know, we went last year and there's a film
On the website at responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's right on the homepage, actually. If you scroll down a little bit, there's an interview with the founder, Kathy Stevens,
Yes, and Kathy does amazing work, and she has a couple of great books out. I know you've interviewed Kathy on It's All About Food. A
couple of times.
A couple of times, and she and her staff there, including the fabulous Michelle, mm-hmm. Are really doing some great work. And we had a chance to go and visit with a lot of the animals, which is what they are all about. And I wanted to ask you, Karen, there are some questions I know that a lot of people have about sanctuary versus petting zoo, sanctuary versus zoo, and these animals that we're seeing at the Catskill Animal Sanctuary are quote-unquote farm animals, and you have some interesting observations about all of that. I wonder if you could share those with
sure.
me and our listeners.
There are a number of sanctuaries across the United States. I don't have the official count off the top of my head. Not many, but there are a significant number of them. And I think we have three here in New York. There's the Woodstock Animal Sanctuary, the Catskill Animal Sanctuary, and the largest and oldest is Farm Sanctuary. What they do is they rescue animals and house animals that have either escaped some harrowing situation, either from a slaughterhouse or from a livestock farm situation where they are destined to be slaughtered and served on someone's plate.
Kathy was talking about at the barn raiser, she was talking about something called hoarders, and I don't quite know what those are.
Yeah. So a lot of their animals at the Catskill Animal Sanctuary are not actually from livestock situations. They're from places where people have animals, and sometimes there are people that collect animals.
Right.
And hoard them. So they keep them in a space, and they don't take care of them, they don't feed them well, and then something happens and someone discovers all of these animals that are malnourished and starving and horribly mistreated, and then someone looks for homes for these, and that's where the sanctuaries come in. If they have the space and if they're able and if they can transport them to their location, they come along and save the day for these
yes,
special
and it's
beings.
Really quite an interesting spot on Earth. You
feel the peace.
You really do. You feel the peace, and I know that you and I both have remarked on how lovely they all seem to be taken care of. And there are pigs and cows and horses and ducks.
Cows and chicks and geese that are scurrying.
Yeah. When I take you out in my hayride. There's they give hayrides, they give tours in the barn. I mean, there's so much going on there. And today we had a chance to just kind of check everything out and really get a close-up look.
But you were asking about sanctuaries.
Right.
And is it an okay thing to do? Because these animals are protected and they are not totally free. They are fenced in. But they do have a lot of room to move and they are well cared for. And the thing is, the situation on the planet today with about 7 billion human beings is there isn't a lot of landmass left over for wildlife to roam freely. We have some wildlife sanctuaries, but basically humanity is encroaching everywhere. And so animals don't have anywhere to go. On the East Coast here in New York and in nearby states, we have an infestation of geese. And there are a lot of geese that come and land on people's front yards, and people don't like it. But these animals don't have anywhere to go. And unfortunately, different cities decide to do unpleasant things, and oftentimes
right.
they kill these animals.
Right.
So these sanctuaries offer space for the fortunate animals that get to go there. The problem is it's really a drop in the bucket. We have
right.
some 60 billion land animals that are killed for food every year.
60 billion, you say?
60 billion.
60 billion.
Is that a crazy number?
60 billion land animals are killed.
Sometimes I hear 58. Sometimes I hear 65. But you know, give or take a billion, and it's frightening.
Right. And so, so another thing that they do at these sanctuaries, Catskill Animal Sanctuary being one of them, is they educate people who maybe aren't aware of the 60 billion land animals killed each year and don't really have an opportunity to get up close and personal with them to see that they aren't too far from domestic pets that we keep at home as far as their personalities are concerned. As a matter of fact, a lot of these land animals that are killed each year for food are very much like your cat or your dog mm-hmm. with respect to their personalities and their and the way they love one another and the way they love you and the way they come to you when you're called. And it's really quite a remarkable thing to see a 1,800-pound cow walk up to you when you call it and give you a kiss. And I saw that today. The gentleman who was leading the hayride walked behind the fence. There was this huge Texas Longhorn. He said it was about 1,800 pounds. Still a baby. Said it'll probably get up to about a ton.
And what are they eating?
And they're eating grass.
They're eating grass.
And he called the cow over and he said, you have to be careful because their horns, thankfully, when they rescued these two large male cows, they did not, the folks that had them before the Catskill Animal Sanctuary was able to rescue them, they did not, as they often do, cut off their horns. And so they still had these great big horns. And it's fly season, meaning there were lots of flies mm-hmm. Having a symbiotic relationship with these cows. And they were flicking their heads. And if you get too close to a cow flicking his head with that size, with those size horns, it could be fatal. So he was telling us how cautious he needs to be. And he said, sometimes he'll give me a kiss. And sure enough, he said kiss, and the cow gave him a big smack on the face, several. And so it was really quite remarkable to see that. And not unlike something your dog or cat would do.
There's definitely a connection.
Right.
And when you talk to these animals, they pick up their head. Yeah. They acknowledge you. They look you in the eye.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things about these sanctuaries, because they have stories to tell about each one of these animals that is there. And
they have names for all of them. And
they're not an it.
Right. They're family.
They're someone. They're individuals.
It's really remarkable. If you get an opportunity and you're in the area, please go and visit one of these sanctuaries and find out if there's one in your neck of the woods, because they need our support. They are nonprofit for the most part, and they're very much they're unlike a petting zoo, and they're unlike a regular zoo because they are there specifically to educate you about how precious these lives are. So the other thing I wanted to ask you, and I think I might have touched on it today, Karen, was when an animal like this is rescued, it does take quite a few people, volunteers included, to maintain not only this 100 plus acre farm, but also to get these animals back in shape. And so there's really round the clock care that a lot of them need.
Yeah, well, Kathy Stevens, the founder of Catskill Animal Sanctuary, has written two books now, and they're both excellent and give good descriptions of some of the stories of rescuing some of the animals and then bringing them.
And our listeners can find out a little bit more about Kathy and the sanctuary by going to your archived.
Yeah, I have two interviews with Kathy. Yeah, Catskill Animal Sanctuary. They could just Google Catskill Animal Sanctuary. But that's not the only one. That's the one that we've spent a bit of time with this week. But there are many other sanctuaries around the country, and I think they're all worthwhile.
And while we were there, we met one of the volunteers. And do you remember what his name was?
I think it was Rahim.
Rahim.
Yeah.
And Rahim just went vegan.
Yeah, I asked him. He might have asked me first, how long have you been vegan? And I said something like, I think it's almost 25 years. And then for him, he said it's been almost 3. And I asked him, I always like to ask people what made them go vegan, what lifted the veil for them, using your expression, Gary.
I think that was John Robbins' expression.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, and, okay. And
I picked it up from John. Or it was one of John's, a friend of John's, I think. We were at the house, and he said, my veil was lifted several years ago, and I thought that that was a nice...
Yeah, it's a great expression. Anyway, he said that this particular guy that we met at the sanctuary, he said that he has a cat, and he's had this cat for like 10 years, and he just made the connection between this animal, this cat that he loved, and the food that he was eating, and that they weren't different.
Right.
And he wouldn't eat his cat, and he went vegan. But... even though he said he's been vegan for 3 years, he still wasn't sure about baking, vegan baking, because there were some wonderful cupcakes at this event, and he was moaning or bemoaning the fact that there weren't any left.
Right.
And I said, well, you can make your own. And he was confused because he said, well, don't I need a special kind of binder or something? And I guess he hasn't discovered... all of the baking, vegan baking cookbooks out there, like Vegan Cupcakes Take Over the World, or the
Fran Costigan's books, who I know you've interviewed as well.
Absolutely. She makes, what's great about her, any event.
Yeah, Fran wasn't there. That's why they ran out of cupcakes.
She's always bringing cupcakes.
Lots of them.
But it's really easy to make vegan cupcakes. You can Google recipes online. We have a number of cake recipes at responsibleeatingandliving.com. But the binder, the first thing is most baked goods, if you're using wheat flour.
First of all, let's define binder for our non-chefs out there who are just starting out. A binder is what? Something you put paper in to take the class? What do you call them on the East Coast?
A loose leaf notebook, Gary.
East Coast calls it loose leaf notebook. West Coast calls it a binder, a three-ring binder.
Okay, why don't you tell us what a binder is?
A binder is something that binds the flour and or whatever ground powdery substance you're using, be it a wheat flour, a rice flour, a...
You mean like glue?
A quinoa flour. Yeah, like glue. And I know in the old days, I would use eggs to bind my cupcakes. But today, I don't use eggs. I use things like Karen.
Okay.
I don't use Karen.
Even before we talk about substitutes, the amazing thing is, if you're using a wheat flour, for example, and you mix it up with water and add a little baking powder to it or baking soda... you don't even need anything else because there's gluten in wheat flour, and gluten will do the gluing for you. Gluten will do the binding for you without any eggs at all. If you're using other flours, then it gets a little trickier. But for most traditional baking with white flour, just leave the egg out. You won't even notice a difference.
But if somebody wants to use an egg replacer, they could, in fact, get an egg replacer at the supermarket. And the one that I've seen commonly used is, I don't remember the name of it now.
It's Ener-G egg replacer. It's a combination of starches, including tapioca and potato starch.
Right.
And so that's pretty good at binding.
Right. I know you also use flax seeds, right? You use that a lot.
Yeah. What I was going to say, one more thing that's interesting about the Ener-G egg replacer is you mix it up with water and you can actually beat it and it will become foamy and stiff like egg whites.
Wow. I've seen that happen.
And
it's
you can
pretty phenomenal.
Fold it into your batter and make the batter lighter, airier.
Right. So, I mean, and then as far as a lot of folks out there maybe are wondering what other ingredients they can use to substitute some of the dairy products that go in baked goods like cupcakes, which we are discussing today.
Well, you just asked about flax seeds.
Right.
And flax seeds they're magical, really magical.
Magical. They're so magical.
They're so magical. Number one, flax seeds are really nutritious because they're loaded with omega-3 fatty acids, which we need for lots of good things in our bodies. And they're important for the heart. They're important for healthy skin. They do so many things. And many people aren't getting the omega-3s that they need. And you often hear, eat salmon.
Yeah, but don't they think that fish is the only way to get them?
Yeah, but flax seeds are a great way to get them. So I like to put flax seeds in, like, everything. And they're great in baked goods because, number one, you have to grind them. And what I typically do is I buy the seed and I grind it right away and I put a whole jar of ground flax seeds either in the freezer or the refrigerator. And then I use them. They can go rancid if you buy the meal in a store. You don't know when they were ground. So it's best to buy the seed and grind it. Okay, and then we have the ground flax seeds ready to go. When you mix ground flax seeds with water, this is where the magic starts.
Yeah, it becomes very...
very gooey, like egg whites.
Right. It's pretty phenomenal.
And so I just like to throw them in almost everything I bake.
Right.
Just because I think it gives a nice texture to the baked goods and you're getting the extra omega-3 fatty acids.
And they're sort of flavorless too, aren't they? I mean, I know they have a flavor, but they don't have an overpowering flavor.
Right. You don't taste them in the baked goods. You might taste them if you put them in a salad.
Right.
It's a light, oily flavor.
Right.
But it's not very overpowering.
Right. Okay. So if someone needs to use, and I know you cover this a lot on Ask a Vegan, but
We
need to repeat this. If the recipe, you can always take a conventional recipe and veganize it. It's pretty simple. You replace the eggs with egg replacer, flax seeds, one of the binders that we discussed. The milk obviously is replaced with a soy milk or an almond milk or an unsweetened milk if you don't want to add any extra sugar, because I'm sure a cake recipe has plenty of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And then, basically there's a lot of recipes that call for butter, and there are butter replacements out there that are vegan. One of them that we use often is
Earth Balance.
And I know that you've talked a lot on your shows about how Earth Balance is trying to be environmentally sustainable with respect to the palm oil that it uses. And so it's really trying to be conscious with that. And so what we try to do at Responsible Eating and Living is talk to you about some of these companies that are responsible with the way they manufacture and distribute their products. And Earth Balance, I think, is really trying to do a pretty good job.
I think so. I like to say that you can have your cake, your vegan cake, and eat it too. I don't think we should feel guilty about eating good food, nutritious food, and even a treat.
Right.
Once in a
while. But let's talk about what this replacer, this butter replacement is. It's really essentially just oil that the water has been removed from to give it more of a denseness, right?
Well, I'm not sure of the manufacturing process that they go through to make a vegan butter. In the old days, they would take a vegetable oil, which was liquid at room temperature, and go through some intense processing called hydrogenation and make a hydrogenated vegetable oil, which was solid at room temperature. The problem is hydrogenated vegetable oil are really unhealthy.
Right. And that's perfect because you played right into my point. My point is you don't really need to use a butter replacement if it calls for butter. You just really need to use some sort of a fat. And what is it that we have found to be an excellent fat? Sometimes it comes in a can. Sometimes we've just found that it comes in a little carton.
Coconut,
right. And a really great way to get the fat out of a can of coconut is to refrigerate the can of coconut so that the fat solidifies.
Mm-hmm.
Take a can opener. Remember those? I think in Bye Bye Birdie, they called them church keys. And pop a couple of holes in the top of the can, pour off the liquid, and keep that for another use, and then take a can opener and open the can and you can scoop out this dense coconut fat. And I think it works even better than a replacer for margarine or butter.
It's good. It's delicious, but it does have its own unique flavor.
Right.
And it's, you have to like that.
A tropical flavor. And I think you should make everything tropical.
Yeah, so there are some recipes that call for butter. You can actually use olive oil or another liquid vegetable oil without a problem. And you can even use oils in pie crust recipes and cake recipes.
Right. It doesn't have to be butter.
It's just going to maybe taste differently.
Right.
And in sometimes I like it better.
I do too. I agree with you there.
But and then I've played with lots of different things using nut butters.
Nut butters are excellent.
Instead of butter.
We use tahini a lot in some of our recipes at Responsible Eating and Living as a butter or butter replacement.
It's great in cookies and pie crusts. It's amazing. And the great thing is it's more nutritious because the nut butter has fiber in it.
Right.
The nut butter, it's processed, but it's minimally processed. It's just blended
and,
up,
you know,
nuts.
While we're on the subject of just blended up nuts, no pun intended, a lot of the nut butters that are out on the market are filled with a lot of different things in addition to, sometimes you even find nuts in the peanut butter. But some of the other things that are in peanut butter are pretty frightening. So you really do have to, I know Karen is telling you this constantly, read your labels.
Read your labels.
But peanut butter should just be what?
What's in your peanut butter? That's my favorite rant if you haven't heard this show before. What's in your peanut butter? It should be peanuts, period.
Right.
And okay, I lighten up sometimes and say, okay, you can have a little salt.
No, no salt.
You shouldn't, but that's it. Peanuts, period.
Almond butter should be almonds. Cashew butter should be cashews. And I'd like to start a little rant today, and that is that I know many of you out there, myself included, are fascinated with food shows on television and on the internet. And I think one thing that this show is doing, hopefully, and I know the shows on the website at Responsible Eating and Living, is letting you know that your food preparation does not have to emulate a professionally trained chef on one of these fantastic food shows. It's okay to go into the kitchen and make imperfect food because it will be perfect, meaning you don't have to be a trained chef to get back in the kitchen and do some serious cooking. And I think home cooking should be somewhat imperfect. I think there should be mistakes made in the kitchen. I think there should be mistakes made in general in life, because that's obviously how we learn. So if something doesn't come out quite right, try it again. And I think you'll find that the process is really what's fun.
Well, sometimes you can create something wonderful when you make a mistake.
Right. I know we do all the time. Sorry.
Well, that just reminds me of, I got a question just today about silken tofu. So someone had a recipe for a quiche that required silken tofu. I'm sorry. Someone had a recipe for a quiche that required firm tofu, and they said they accidentally used silken tofu and had it in the oven, and they were really worried that it wasn't going to turn
out. Did you just say a quiche made with tofu? What's that? I thought quiche was made with eggs. Could this be another replacer?
Right. So the traditional French quiche, like the quiche Lorraine, is made with heavy cream, eggs, and it can just be that and a little onion, and it's a cooked savory custard. And then sometimes there's some ham at the bottom of the quiche. And then there are theme and variations on quiche where cheese is added or vegetables are added. And many people now make a totally vegan quiche using that super duper versatile tofu. And you can just whiz it all up in the blender and pour it into a pie crust. But this person had used silken tofu instead of firm tofu, and I said, don't panic. Silken tofu may even give you a better quiche.
A more custardy quiche, I think you said.
Yeah, because silken tofu is smooth and silky, like the name silk.
Okay, so here's a transitioning vegan plug for all of you out there who are really hankering for some chocolate pudding, but know that there's just absolutely no way you can do it if you're trying to be a vegan. Well, I want to tell you, silken tofu makes an excellent chocolate pudding. And I think Karen can recite the recipe off the top of her head.
Sure, you can take half a bag of non-dairy semi-sweet chocolate chips, melt them in a double boiler, and then add in a package of silken tofu. And if you have a hand blender, you can whir it all up right there in the pot, or you can scrape the hot
spectacular
chocolate
so
out
good.
And put it in a blender and add the tofu there and blend it all up, pour it or spoon it into small dishes and chill it.
Or
and,
just eat it right out of the bowl.
You can't wait. Yeah, it's really good.
It's great.
And so easy.
And it's easy. And silken tofu is usually done for used in that application, right? In a real smooth silk.
Yeah, it's good for...
Because what are the differences? You've got the firm tofu, and then you've got the silken firm tofu, and there's different, obviously.
Right, so the silken version is very silky, shiny, smooth, custardy. It's hard to fry.
Right, it's great for sauces and dropping in soups.
It's something that the American palate doesn't enjoy very much as a chunk. You can get a Japanese miso soup, and often there will be little chunks of silken tofu, which is a
very
little
soft.
Too soft and mushy for Americans. But it's great in a blender, as you can use it for sour cream, adding some lemon and other flavorings. You can make dips with it, like an onion dip.
A dill.
With onion powder and garlic powder and some onions, you can add fresh herbs or dried herbs and make all kinds of wonderful different vegetable dish.
You know, the thing I was amazed with when I was...
Because it's creamy.
When I decided to be a vegan was how many products are out on the market that are like sour cream, that are like cream cheese. In addition to the silken tofu and the regular tofu that are dairy-free, and it's really remarkable. You really don't need to ever eat anything that comes from an animal ever again, and you can still get the same taste sensation that you're getting now. So,
yep, that's why we're here.
That's
it's
right.
Easy.
That's why we're here.
And now the other tofu, the not silken version, the regular tofu, it comes in different, what are we, density? Soft,
densities,
medium,
right.
And
very
firm.
Good.
And so the firm has less water in it. It's a drier cake. The softer has more water in it. But if you mash it with a fork, it will look like ricotta cheese. Kind
oh,
of lumpy.
Ricotta.
If you mash silk and tofu with a fork, it doesn't have that lumpiness to it because it's silky and smooth. And so it's just keep it in mind to use for different things. It fries really great.
Right.
It's good in scrambles. Although you like to mix silken
right.
and
yeah, when we're on the subject
tofu.
Of the quiche, and you were mentioning how there's vegetables, sometimes there's an actor at the bottom. Oh, I mean a ham at the bottom. ham at the bottom. You pour the batter on top of that and bake it in the oven. So my batter that I like to make now is, again, we're talking about things that we've already discussed on this show. I take a little bit of tahini. I take a block of regular firm tofu. I take some flax seeds. Mm. And I take some soy milk. And I mix that all together with spices, and again, the spice is up to you. That becomes my batter. I whip it up just like you would whip up a bunch of eggs, and then I add some turmeric, whatever the correct
one day we'll learn how to say
right.
it.
The yellow stuff.
Yellow powder.
And it gives it kind of that egg yolk mixed with egg white look, and saute some onions and some spinach together, and I don't even use a crust. I make it frittata style. And I put that, I put the spinach and onion mixture with a little garlic that's been sauteed together at the bottom of the pan. And then I dump this batter on top and I bake it in a really hot oven at like 400 degrees for about 20 to 25 minutes until it starts bubbling, comes out. And it's really pretty phenomenal.
Okay, now I'm really hungry.
It is really good. You should have eaten some of that salad I made earlier.
Okay. Anyway, I want to move on to some more recipes because I posted a bunch of recipes this week on the Responsible Eating and Living website, and I wanted to give a little more detail.
And you also sent out a fantastic mailer, an emailer. So if you're not on our mailing list, please send us your email address and we can get you directly one of these great emails.
We send them out about once a month, and we have some recipe highlights. So if you haven't been to our Facebook page and if you haven't visited the website recently, when you get the email, you can see what we've been doing and check out the things that are interesting to you. I also list the number of people that I've interviewed during the last few months, so you can see the highlights there. And
one person in particular that I just wanted to make note of again was the chef of Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi's chef. And what is his name again?
Roberto Martin.
And he has a great book out. And it's called Vegan
for Carnivores.
And so basically it's a lot of these dishes that if you eat meat, and are interested in transitioning or just curious about vegan food and cooking, but don't think there's anything for you that you could possibly enjoy, his book seems to be pretty fascinating. And
there's a lot of recipes in it that we've been making for a long time, that a lot of vegans have been eating for a long time, but it's nice to see it in one book with some really nice pictures and a chef's spin on them.
Right. And a celebrity chef's spin. Or a chef to the celebrities.
Okay, there's a restaurant that we like to go to when we go out. And we're not big restaurant eaters. We make a lot of our food at home. But there is a place that we like to go to, and it's in our neighborhood in Queens, in Flushing, and it's called Buddha Bodai. And it's a Chinese restaurant. It is, I think it's like 99.9% vegan. The food is really good.
It's fantastic.
And we always order a big pile of sautéed greens. And you have a choice, and it depends, too, what's in season. But I get watercress whenever I can. And it is so incredibly delicious.
Yes, it is incredibly delicious and very, very good for you.
And I didn't know how to make it. Now, we make greens at home all the time, and they're always delicious. And when we saute our greens, we usually do it with some garlic and some onions, or just onions, and delicious. But I could never get that flavor. And
that Buddha Bodai flavor.
We figured it out.
You figured it out.
Oh, anyway.
Go ahead. I know you're busting to tell everybody. So.
Well, we put the recipe on Responsible Eating and Living, so you can check that out there.
What category is it under?
I put it under sides.
Sides, okay. Remember, check sides.
Well, you could put, what did I put it under? Stir-fried greens in the search bar, or just greens. But a lot of things will come up if you put greens in the search bar, because that's all I ever talk about. But the trick is in two parts, and you helped with one of those parts.
I did?
Yes, you did.
Oh.
So the first thing is, I usually like to keep things really simple and really quick, and so when I'm cooking my greens, I just put them in the fry pan. Sometimes I dry saute them. Sometimes I add a little bit of water. Sometimes I add a tiny bit of oil. But when you do greens, Gary, you parboil the greens first.
Well, I find a lot of the greens are very, very tough if you just go directly into a hot pan. So what you want to do is you want to blanch your greens for at least 5 minutes in boiling water. You give them a nice shock in the hot water, and then make sure you rinse them in cold water. Get a colander right after that, and this will give you an opportunity to kind of drain them a little bit. So if you are using oil, none of the water will cause a little combustion activity in your pan. What am I saying?
Yeah. And anyway.
Anyway, it won't blow up in your face. Yeah. So make sure your greens after you rinse them off are dry, and you can spin them, or you can damp with a nice clean tea towel. You can dry them a little bit. And then, go ahead, Karen.
Okay, so then in a frying pan, I put minimal oil because I'm really not into using a lot of oil. I use an untoasted sesame oil, about a teaspoon, just to coat the bottom of the pan.
So let's stop there a minute, because there are two sesame oils that are out on the market. One is really easy to find, and that's a toasted sesame oil. The other one is not so easy to find, and that's a... I guess you would call it a raw sesame oil, or in...
Yeah, like a cold-pressed sesame oil. It doesn't have much flavor, like the toasted sesame oil. It has a very strong, dark flavor to it.
Yeah, and it's actually quite good to use the untoasted sesame oil in
just
this
for cooking.
Particular dish. But yeah. If you can't find that...
Any oil will do.
Any oil.
Really, it's just to coat the bottom of the pan. I minced ginger and... about 2 tablespoons of minced fresh ginger. Put that in the pan and cooked it for a couple of minutes, watching not to burn it, but you want it to just get a little golden, a little dry, and then throw the greens in there and toss it around for a couple of minutes.
And that was it.
And that's it!
And it was just like Buddha Bodhi, only better.
Better!
Because you made it at home.
Oh gosh, it was so good, and we made it two nights in a row.
Yeah, we still have some in the refrigerator. We're going to make some more.
And you can use any green you want. Watercress. We used Chinese broccoli.
Right.
And spinach will work. Any green will work.
And the thing about where we live, and maybe you have a similar situation where you live, is that most of the businesses in our neighborhood are not chains, or they're not large supermarket. They're still family-owned businesses. And so every now and then we stumble on a little market and it becomes this treasure to us. Mm-hmm. And we get our greens at this one market now. And there's another market we go to and we get olives and tahini. And there's another market we go to. So it's really a lot of fun. And because we are responsible eating and living, the living part of this broadcast is... what's really fun to do is to go out into your neighborhood and explore some of the local businesses, some of the...
On foot,
absolutely, or on your bike, or on your skateboard, or on something that you power yourself instead of in your car, and see if there's these little markets and things like that that have these specialty items, because I know a lot of the markets in our neighborhood here in Queens have a lot of specialty items that you would never find at, what, Safeway, if that's where you live, or
Publix,
or some of the big
Wall
markets.
Walbaum's in New York.
And I know there's a lot of big markets now that are carrying a lot of specialty items, like Whole Foods, of course, but that's even getting kind of chain-like. And, you know, they have a balance sheet that they need to take care of at the end of every month. So I know that the smaller markets have the specialty items like raw sesame oil, which is something that I haven't been able to find in one of the big supermarkets yet.
Well, what I like about these ethnic markets is they have their own character. Sure, Whole Foods and Trader Joe's, we shop there, we like it, but... to some extent, they're the same. You know what you're getting. And
right.
I don't want to lose the diversity.
Plus, if you buy a lot of frozen food or a lot of packaged food, you really have no idea how long it's been sitting on the shelf or how long it's been sitting in the freezer in the factory before it's actually been loaded onto the truck and brought to the store. Sure, it's got dates on it, but I don't really think that those dates are reliable, so I'd be very careful. And I think... I think what we're trying to say here at Responsible Eating and Living is that you could really do a lot of this stuff on your own. Going back to the gentleman at the Catskill Animal Sanctuary who was upset about the fact that they ran out of vegan cupcakes, he was afraid he wasn't going to be able to find a binder to make his cupcakes. And we just basically set him straight, Karen did, and just said, you know, it's easy.
It's a piece of cake.
Exactly. It's a piece of cake. Your father would be proud of that pun.
Another recipe I put up this week which has been getting a lot of comments, is a banana bread recipe. So when I was young in New York, there was a restaurant that my family would go to pretty much on special occasions. You know, going out to the restaurant back in the 70s was not as much an everyday thing as it is for many families today.
No, and it was a special occasion.
So it was a special occasion, and there was this one place called Cookie Steak Pub, and obviously they serve steak, but they had their own spin on things. So you would order your steak or some other main dish, and of course they had giant baked potatoes. They served iceberg lettuce, and what they did was they cut the iceberg head into four quarters, and you would be served a quarter, just a chunk like that, not separated or anything. And then they would have this serving dish that had four bowls, and each bowl had some heavy dressing, Russian dressing and blue cheese dressing. And
that was called the salad dressing caddy.
Okay.
For you restaurateurs out there.
There you go.
Of the 70s generation. And then the four stainless steel bowls and the little carrying caddy.
Okay, right? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, that's because, you know, I am a professional.
And then they had a shrimp cocktail bar, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but I want to get over to the banana bread, and they had a banana bread bar. And this was just, I couldn't eat enough of this banana bread. It was really something else. Now, probably today I wouldn't care very much for it. It would probably be too sweet for me, and who knows what they made it with. But I decided I would make my own banana bread, and we put that recipe up on Responsible Eating and Living recently. You can find it under Quick Breads, and it's gluten-free. It's made with oatmeal. It's made with bananas.
Right.
And a few other natural, nutritious ingredients, and it's really, really delicious.
Wait, did you say it's made with oatmeal?
Banana
bread made with oatmeal?
My banana bread is really like a deconstructed, reconstructed bowl of oatmeal.
It is. It is. It truly is. And it's a little mini loaf, too, just like they served at, what was the name of that restaurant?
Cookie Steak Pub.
Cookie Steak Pub.
Yeah. So the other thing was this shrimp cocktail bar. And even today, there are places that serve unlimited shrimp.
Sizzler.
Oh, is it Sizzler?
That's when I was growing up, it was Sizzler.
Anyway, what many people don't realize is a number of things. Number one, shrimp is loaded with cholesterol. Shellfish in general are probably the least healthiest of all of the sea life that you could possibly consume because they're bottom dwellers, meaning they eat garbage.
I owned a couple of restaurants, and one of my chefs used to call shrimp cockroaches of the sea.
Cockroaches
of the sea.
But the thing most people don't realize today is that many shrimp, or the shrimp that you're getting in a lot of these restaurants, is farmed shrimp. And the way the shrimp are farmed is really devastating to the environment. And it's damaging many coral reefs, and it's not a good thing at all.
It's damaging to the shrimp, too.
Well, of course. So, that's what I think of when I think of these shrimp bars. And I just heard somebody wrote to me about, there are a number of companies that make meat analogs and fish analogs.
What's that, Karen?
It's something that looks and feels and tastes to some degree like
meat
or fish, but it's made from plant foods.
And it's a great thing, too, because a lot of transitioning vegans and really, this is like a lifeline for some of you out there, I'm sure, and you probably haven't discovered them yet, but some of these meat analogs or meat substitutes really come in handy when you think you can't make it any longer and you just walk into the deli section of your large grocery store and find that package of tofurkey on the counter and kind of saves you. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, there are some shrimp analogs.
Sure.
And when we've gotten them sometimes at a store called Mewa here in New York City, and there are some others. And when you get them just kind of plain, I don't really like them, but when you doll them up, bread them, fry them, do what people do with shrimp.
Or prawns. I think we're talking more like the breaded prawns deep fried.
Yeah, they are really
amazing.
Yeah,
one time at a restaurant in the village called Red Bamboo, we got this hankering for some deep fried food. I don't know why. Bought this mixed basket of deep fried shrimp analog and fish fillet analog or something. And I literally thought that they had brought me the actual thing. It was so scary. Good.
And someone just told me about, I think it's called Sophia's Vegan Kitchen, where you can order by mail, I think.
I have to find out.
A variety
that.
Of different things, including fried shrimp.
Wow.
Which is vegan.
Vegan fried shrimp.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to talk about one thing before we go to the next item on your list, which are these fantastic corn cakes. We were talking about tofu earlier, and I know you've said this many times, but in case we have any new listeners, tofu, in my research, came up bean, soybean cheese. So they actually call it a cheese. And there's a lot of these, we're talking about analogs, meats, meat analogs. There's a lot of cheese substitutes out there now, too, on the market. And I just wanted to also remind myself, and then in doing so, remind you that tofu was originally called soybean cheese, and it's made the same way that cheese is made, with animal milk, but it's only made with pressed.
It's soybeans. The juice from soybeans,
right? So it's made the same way; it just doesn't melt like a animal milk that's full of animal fat.
It's curdled like cheese.
Right.
Yeah.
And you were talking about ricotta. As a second generation Italian American, I grew up with ricotta, and there's a really interesting thing you can do. You can make a simple ricotta by crumbling some extra firm tofu and squeezing a little lemon on it, and you won't even know the difference. It's really, really good.
Really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, tofu is magical.
It's magical. Okay. Are you done with the bread, the banana bread nostalgia?
Yeah, I think so.
Because that really got a lot of hits on...
Yeah, well, I started talking about this one restaurant and people that are from this area remembered it.
Cookie's Steakhouse.
Cookie's Steak Pub.
Oh, Steak Pub.
And then Cookie's had another restaurant, a family restaurant, in the same campus of stores. And it was a family restaurant. I used to get a turkey dinner. The desserts were simple, like rice pudding and chocolate pudding.
You never ate turkey.
Gosh, I did when I was a child.
I can't believe
that. I used to say, turkey's been good this year. And I put my apologies out to the universe over and over, especially when we saw those turkeys running around.
I've seen you walk up to turkeys and apologize.
Animal sanctuary.
I've seen you walk up to many animals and apologize.
Well, you know, the thing is, especially after going to the sanctuary... It just boggles my mind. How did we ever eat animals? Where did we get the idea? I mean, just looking at a pig, you do not want to go run up and take a bite out of them.
No, you don't.
No, you don't. It's gross. Okay, I digress. Corn cakes. So, I have a recipe for corn cakes on ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com.
And what's it under? What category?
I believe it's also under quick breads.
Quick breads, okay.
Or breakfast. And I kind of rediscovered or was introduced to the amazing qualities of corn flour, masa harina, masa arepa, and polenta from the Viva Vegan book by Terry Hope Romero. So
great
there's
book.
A number of recipes in there using masa harina and masa arepa because she goes into her Latin roots. And you can get masa harina in some supermarkets, especially if you're in an area with a large Hispanic community. You know where they sell the Goya beans, the
right.
Goya brand.
Here's where those specialty stores come in, or those local mom-and-pop stores, which are so precious to our economy.
And what's nutty, and I never realized this, is you can take the masa harina, mix it up with a little water, and make a batter, and just put it in a lightly greased frying pan, and you can make corn cakes.
It's
just
amazing.
Cooks like that. Just corn and water, nothing else.
You guys, I wouldn't have believed it if I had seen it. She just whipped it up by adding...
It was crazy. So I don't buy Mascarina very often for a number of reasons. One is I have not found it organic.
Organic?
Organic. And Gary's Italian, and he always
makes sure that
we have polenta in the house.
That's right. You got to have polenta. It's a staple.
And so polenta is a coarse grind of corn, and I think it's probably a different variety of corn because the flavor isn't the same as Mascarina.
Well, you can make polenta by grinding popcorn. I've done it before, and I've kneaded polenta and haven't had any in the house, but I found some popcorn. I took out my spice mill and ground it up, and I made some polenta. I'm serious.
So what I did was I took the polenta that we had, and I put it in a food processor and ground it up a little more to make it a little finer, and then made some corn cakes. Now, I like to add fresh corn kernels or frozen corn kernels. I like the juicy crunch that it gives. And then you can flavor them up any way you want. You can add onions. You can add garlic. You can add
these are great
anything,
corn
but they're so easy.
Check out the recipe, you guys. You won't be disappointed. All right, it's barbecue season, right?
Yeah, we just have a few minutes left, like four.
I know, and I got to get in my pointers about this great recipe that we have on the website for vegetables, barbecued vegetables. I think they're called grilled vegetables. You can find them under, I believe, main courses. Check out that recipe. It's amazing. And write us if you have any questions about it. It's really a spectacular way to keep that grill going, guys out there. Hey, men, if you really want to grill something and you're trying to be a vegan, do the grilled vegetables. Also, a great thing to grill is pizza. You can actually make a pizza on your barbecue pit.
And, no way.
Yeah, way. And there's a lot of great recipes out there for that. And here's where those cheese substitutes come in. And I know that Karen and I have a couple of cheese recipes on our website. But if you aren't, if you're a little precautious about making your own cheese, there's a couple of great vegan cheeses out on the market. And I'm not going to plug any one in particular, but make sure you read your label, because it should not contain
casein.
In order, if it's vegan, it doesn't have casein. So it'll
there are a number of soy cheeses out there, and you think that they're vegan.
But they're not.
They're not. They have casein.
Casein.
Which is the glue in milk. It's a milk protein. Okay, Gary, this has really been fun.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, so
I'm gonna play the real jingle, and we're out of here. We gotta go watch the Tonys.
Let's watch the Tonys. That's why I'm wearing this tux.
Okay, thanks for listening.
Thanks
Remember,
for listening.
info@realmeals.org.
Bye bye, everybody.
Bye.
R-E-A-L.
Responsible eating and living.
R-E-A-L.
Reels, good for the planet, the inhabitants who need sound advice on the right thing to do.
When it comes to good health,
we need facts that are true. To choose what to eat and save the planet too. That's responsible eating and living.
You'll find the real tools for you.
Real.